All right, everybody, thanks for joining us today. We're going to get started here. Come on in and take a seat. We still have lots of seats up front, as usual. Thanks for joining us. My name is Sunshine Menezes. I'm the Executive Director of the Metcalf Institute for Marine and Environmental Reporting at the University of Rhode Island's Graduate School of Oceanography. And I am pleased, on behalf of my co-organizer here, Bud Ward, from the Yale Forum on Climate Change in the Media, to welcome you all to the first of two sessions that we've organized today. We have brought a number of business journalists here today to attend these sessions to try to expand membership within SEJ and also to get some new voices and perspectives in this very important issue of the economics of climate change. And I feel really fortunate for us to go right after that plenary session, because there were a lot of great comments that were made that kind of tee us off for this conversation today. I guess probably the most obvious one would be when Congressman Sensenbrenner said that the costs of climate change will be, quote, devastating, end quote. And so there are a lot of question marks about this. If those costs indeed will be devastating, then how do we actually assess this, costs versus impacts? And what are the costs, the true costs of innovation? And to help us answer some of those questions today, we're very pleased to welcome Dr. Frank Ackerman from Tufts University, sitting here at the end of the table. Frank is an economist and a professor at Tufts, as I said. He's written extensively about the economics of climate change and other environmental problems. He's written several books, including Can We Afford the Future?, Economics for a Warming World, Poisoned for Pennies, The Economics of Toxics and Precaution, and Priceless, On Knowing the Price of Everything and the Value of Nothing. Since 2007, he's worked jointly with the GDAE, and the Stockholm Environment Institute, which is a research program on climate economics specifically. He received his PhD in economics from Harvard and is a founder and member of the steering committee of Economists for Equity and Environment and a member scholar of the Center for Progressive Reform. In a few minutes, he will tell us about a new report that they just issued that is shown here. The title is shown here, The Economics of 350, Can We Afford to Respond to Climate Change? And then we will have remarks from John Kerry of Business Week, who Bud is going to introduce.
Thank you, Sunshine, and again, welcome to you all. We're glad you're here. I think it's going to be a stimulating discussion. I do get the honor of introducing John Kerry, who will open the questions and hopefully grill Frank Ackerman, get him to elaborate, challenge him, do what any good journalist does. And that's what John Kerry has been for the past 20 years with Business Week in the Washington, D.C. Bureau, where he's senior correspondent. He previously was an editor of The Scientist, and in his past has included stints with Newsweek and the National International Wildlife magazines. John's won a number of prestigious journalism awards, and importantly, some peer awards, the Overseas Press Club, the National Magazine Award. He doesn't have the educational background that so many science journalists have, like me, with a bachelor's degree in English Lit from Oberlin or something like that. John actually has a bachelor's degree in biochemistry from Yale. He got his master's in marine biology from the University College of North Wales, and then he got a forest ecology master's degree from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And I'm proud to say John was one of the participants in the journalism workshops that are detailed in the book, the Green Book, that's been passed out. And I'm proud also to say that that's a collaboration with my colleague, Sunshine, who is a very demanding editor, for which I appreciate her great efforts. So anyway, I hope you'll take that with you. We also put out the full report that Jane Luchenco referred to about climate impacts in the U.S. That helps regionalize this story from being just polar bears and icebergs. So that's also available here. And with that, Sunshine, take it away.
Well, we're going to start first with having Frank Ackerman give an intro to this, as Bud just described, and then John's going to respond. At that point, we will invite questions from the audience, and as is always the case, please be sure to identify yourself first when you ask a question. SEJ members, working journalists, get first crack at this, and we appreciate your very concise wording in your questions. Thank you. Dr. Ackerman.
Okay, well, thanks for inviting me. Thanks to the audiovisual team here who responded to my request for PowerPoint facilities very quickly at the last minute. I had no idea this conference normally didn't use PowerPoint. I'm going to talk about the economics of climate change. When I agreed to do this talk some months ago, I did not realize that how perfect the timing would be. We had a major report released Tuesday, called the Economics of 350, the references to the 350 parts per million target for climate stabilization. It came out October 6th. It's released by Economists for Equity and Environment, a network of 200 economists who are interested in environmental issues from an equity perspective, from a somewhat activist point of view. You can't read the names of the authors. There are 8 economists listed as authors. I'm the lead author of the report. Well, you listen to things about the climate, you certainly could imagine that you're being told that we're doomed, right? Even though climate policy is finally moving forward, we are starting to see this year, the new Congress, new administration, some serious discussion of emissions reductions, some momentum around the world, and more or less almost on track, or you know, within sight of being on track for heading for a stabilization target of 450 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. I assume these kind of numbers are familiar. 280 parts per million is the pre-industrial level, which we are climbing ever farther above. But as climate policy is finally moving forward, climate science seems to be moving faster. There's more and more evidence coming out, even since the IPCC report and the Stern Review, major reports that came out 2 years ago based on the science as of 3 years ago. The situation has gotten much worse since then. The suggestion that serious harms are possible, not always certain, but possible at lower temperatures and lower CO2 concentrations than we ever suspected. I'm not going to try to do a detailed review of the science, but I'll mention things that James Hansen, the top climate scientist at NASA, and until recently a relatively apolitical individual who didn't give a lot of talks about what it meant. That's all changed. He has 2 findings which we took seriously in this in suggesting how hard is the economic challenge of responding to this. One of his key findings is an argument which he makes at some length, he and colleagues make at some length, that a doubling of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere will cause 6 degrees Celsius of warming rather than the 3 degrees previously believed. This is the so-called climate sensitivity parameter of the climate models. How bad warming is going to be for you is often expressed in these terms of how many degrees of warming will we get for each doubling of the CO2 concentrations. Hansen's other disturbing idea is that a review of the paleoclimate data, the review of the geological records and fossil records, suggests that 450 parts per million, which has previously been seen as a safe target, is right around the threshold at which in the geological record you have a transition to a completely ice-free Earth. No glaciers, no ice caps, no ice sheets. This means disastrously higher sea levels, clearly flooding all coastal cities. It means the destruction of the glacier-fed water systems that make life possible in Western North America and for gigantic numbers of people in Asia. Simply a catastrophe. So if 450 parts per million is the threshold at which that starts to happen, seems like climate protection might require moving on beyond this 450 that we have more or less started to get our arms around toward this very stringent 350 parts per million target. This cartoon conveys some of the spirit of the climate debate, the policy debate in Washington, which seems completely disconnected from the urgency of the science. I imagine it was a fire in case of global warming. Make sure everyone in the building agrees there's a fire. Bring in a few outside skeptics and let them talk. Consider it may just be a small fire. Realize that calling the fire department isn't free, you know, and on and on. That sort of how did we get stuck in this cartoon as the real science is going on? The dilemma of policy insofar as the economic ideas, such as the idea that higher electric rates would absolutely destroy Jim Sensenbrenner's constituents, we are trying to address those kind of economic misconceptions and talk about what's really going on. The science that is sounding more and more bleak is not increasing the cost of doing something. It's increasing the cost of doing nothing. But I'm not mostly going to talk about the cost of doing nothing. I assume that you've gotten depressed enough listening to climate scientists. I'm going to try to talk about what do we know about the cost of doing something about it, which has not been escalating. It's not been getting bigger as a result of all this new climate science. We tried to clarify what's meant by the 350 parts per million target, which Hansen, although he has proposed it and it's started to be out in popular debate, it's not yet really clear exactly what it means. And the question of 350 by when is a crucial question, especially because we are now around 390 and rising. And CO2 has a very long residence time in the atmosphere, so getting it to go down is a very slow process. That's the nature of the dilemma. Even stopping by 450 was going to take some real work. Getting it to literally go down from the present concentrations is much harder. So Hansen's proposal is that we should hit 350 parts per million of CO2 by the end of the century, as fast as one can actually imagine without a complete economic collapse. In his scenario for achieving this, coal is either eliminated or 100% combined with carbon capture and storage, so there's no more emissions from coal. Oil and gas are still used, but their prices escalate rapidly, discouraging people from using them. Stopping deforestation and making rapid moves toward reforestation is crucial. Study after study shows this is the cheapest thing to do. There's a huge potential. A lot of it is in the rainforests of developing countries. Other places matter too, but the largest, cheapest opportunities are, if we can figure out the institutional questions, to stop deforestation and instead switch over to reforestation in the tropical forest areas. With the combination of reforestation and carbon capture and storage, Hansen projects that the world can and must reach negative net emissions by mid-century and stay there for a long time. So that's his plan in a nutshell for how to get there. In our study, we decided to look at something a little more gradual. What if you don't quite believe in negative net emissions? We concluded that in that case, 350 by 2200 is about as fast as you can get there. It requires that you eliminate virtually all carbon emissions by the middle of the century, figure out the carbon-free economy a little faster than people are talking about. A lot of the scenarios that are being discussed, the 80% reduction by 2050, you got most of the century to figure it out. This says you need to do it in the next 50 years or so, figure out the carbon-free economy. The problem is, if you believe this view of the science, the more time you spend significantly above 350 parts per million, the lower the costs are, but the greater the risk of a irreversible catastrophic climate event is. So that there's a very clear trade-off, which I will come back to talking more about. Now, at about this point, or somewhere early in the discussion, you often encounter the idea that this is simply impossible, that our way of life is based on carbon emissions, fossil fuels, and that, you know, isn't this asking people to live in tents without electricity or something like that? And my whole approach to this, there is a little bit of a manic depressive. Some of it's really down and some of it's really up. But in terms of the evidence that there isn't any fixed relationship between carbon emissions and well-being, and that, you know, there must be a way to make big changes at roughly the same level of income. In another report that we did, we looked at carbon emissions by state. So this is per capita CO2 emissions by U.S. state a few years ago. The national average is there, and you can see the staggering level, the variation from just over 10 to over 70 tons of carbon dioxide per person per year by U.S. state. This is even after correcting for electricity exports and imports, as each state is being charged for the electricity it consumes in these data. And because you can't read all of this data, I highlighted the two biggest states. California is about 12 and Texas is about 30. Now, it's my belief that they are at about the same standard of living compared to countries of the world. And California is not the lowest and Texas is not the highest. But notice that with similar standards of living, California has 40% of the per capita CO2 emissions of Texas. I see everyone's heads twisted over. You're trying to read where your state is. The very lowest state is Vermont, which has a lot of hydropower and some nuclear power, essentially no fossil fuel electricity. All the West Coast states, California and New York. New York is down there because New York City is such an energy-efficient way to live. All the West Coast states, some of New England, are very low. At that low end, you're down in the European range. That the states down there around California and below have emissions per capita at the level of European countries. At the other end, you have emissions at the level of the highest OPEC countries and beyond. Louisiana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Alaska, all the way up there, big coal and oil burning states. The top part of the bar is residential and transportation energy. The bottom darker part is industrial and commercial. I guess that's not quite showing on the graph. But still, if you started from Texas and you said, we've got to eliminate CO2, we've got to transform our economy to eliminate CO2 emissions, you could get more than halfway there by accepting the hardship of living like Californians. We've all seen the movies. It doesn't look that hard. I tried to develop this story in talking to some of the environmental groups in Washington about European countries. I said, look at Germany. Germany has higher incomes than we do, higher wages, longer vacations, better medical care. They make really nice cars, and they drive them really fast. And they have half of our per capita emissions. And the response from environmental groups was that the people who needed to be persuaded didn't know or care anything about foreign countries, which had a depressing ring of truth to it. But this was sort of a second round of that argument of saying, well, the variation in U.S. states, the West Coast, New York, some of New England, is practically as low as essentially in the same range as those major European countries. How hard would it be to live like New York or California? Okay, well, enough uplifting interlude. So we set out to look at the cost estimates that have been made. There's a tremendous literature on estimates of the costs of climate policies. That's what most of our report is about. I invite you to find it and download it. I won't present all of it, but the impression that there is a huge range of estimates and that some estimates show huge costs comes from a very small number of sources. The Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers have promoted several studies using several different models that find enormous costs, that they do find that there will be economic ruin, thousands of dollars lost per household based on the mildest climate policies. These are based on proprietary models, which they are not willing to publicize the details of. Unlike all the other studies I will discuss here, all of which have made their data and their models available to the public as part of normal scientific discourse, these are private consulting firms with proprietary models. To the extent that we can see what they are assuming about some things, the bias in their assumptions includes this extreme market rigidity. There's no innovation. There's almost no increase in use of alternative fuels as carbon prices go up. No one else ever finds costs like these. And it's remarkable to me as an economist. I mean, these are a lot of the people who, in other areas of life, celebrate the free market. right? And you listen to their celebration of the free market. It's this wonderfully elastic system that responds to this and that and the other. Faced with regulation, it becomes a piece of delicate, breakable crystal. The phase transition is breathtaking. But there's a nice study by Eric Pooley, who's at the Harvard Kennedy School, who did a study of the excessive attention that's been paid to these handful of biased studies, much like the climate skeptics. These are the climate economic skeptics. Estimates from major modeling groups, Harvard, MIT, government agencies, a couple of other big university groups that have major climate economics models, have looked at similar kind of U.S. policies, Lieberman, Warner, different proposals that have gone by, and they routinely find little or no net effect. These are small policies. They're not enough. The proposals that are being made are not big enough to do the job, but they are absolutely not going to destroy the economy, according to anyone except the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. You know, they're too small to solve the problem, too small to hurt the economy. Environmental Defense Fund published a nice survey by Nat Cohane and Peter Goldmark reviewing this world of modeling. This cartoonist does wonderful pictures of the unbearable costs that the auto industry is facing, driving up this mountain of proposed fuel efficiency standards, which are almost but not quite as high as the standards already adopted in China. So on to more serious economic modeling, the heart of the estimates that we found in the literature. We did a small modeling exercise of our own, but we put more credence, actually, on our review of the literature. Most of the academic studies, there's a real time lag in academic studies, and a lot of them are looking at the targets that were being talked about 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, 450, 550 parts per million, or even above. So we looked hard through the literature, found 4 major modeling groups that have, you know, big climate economics models that tried to work out the world economy in some detail. All 4 of them turn out to be at European universities. No one in the U.S. has done this, but it's a global problem. It's an interesting literature. The 4 of them that are out there, one of them makes this assumption that we're starting from a world with a lot of unemployment. What would it do to have very strong climate policies where we had to spend money on renewable energy and energy efficiency, dropped into an economy with a lot of unemployment? And their conclusion was that over this century you would see more economic growth, essentially a Keynesian effect of the economic stimulus. The other 3 made the assumption, which is more common in long-run modeling, that over a century you can't have much change in unemployment. You know, you can't do a 100-year model in which the unemployment rate changes by 1% every year. I mean, just play it out, and there's nothing left at the end. So if you assume the same unemployment at the beginning and the end, the other groups all pretty much found 1 to 3% of world output would be required to solve the problem. 1 to 3% of output would be consumed to solve the problem. There's a lot of technological detail modeling something like this over 100 years. You start looking at what are the energy technologies going to look like, and the further out you go into the century, the more the new technologies matter. There's a wide range, which we talk about in the report. One of them really liked the idea of conversion to hydrogen fuel in the second half of the century and thought that that was the way to go. Carbon capture and storage comes in for a lot of attention. Reforestation is, of course, big. How fast will costs go down on renewable energy? There are differing assumptions about that. I thought it was interesting, in terms of the intensity of the debate about nuclear power, that none of these 4 groups that modeled the costs of 350 assumed that you could get rid of nuclear power. None of them assumed you could solve any problems by expanding it either. It's sort of, you know, what you see is what you got. One of them said there isn't enough uranium around to do a lot more than that unless you start having breeder reactors and reprocessing fuel, and then there's a whole other set of questions that come up there. Finally, there's a bunch of optimists. The McKinsey Company, it's an international consulting firm, has taken on doing very detailed estimates of the costs of abatement, lining up in order of increasing cost. What are the ways that you could reduce carbon emissions? They've looked at hundreds of different technologies, and they have concluded that you could get rid of more than half of world emissions at an incredibly low cost. A good chunk of that you could do for zero or negative costs. You actually make money, but some of it would have net costs. Looking into their studies, they make it more or less divides into thirds. Energy efficiency is one third. Low carbon energy sources, you know, new renewables is another third. And forestry and agriculture is another third. The potential that can be done in forest management, soil management remains large and remains cheap in everyone's studies. And finally, there are a few environmental groups that have done studies. Greenpeace did a global study. Union of Concerned Scientists did a U.S.-only study in which they did very detailed technology projections, finding that the savings would outweigh the abatement costs. The fuel savings would be much greater than what was spent. And they're, you know, in some sense, they're the other extreme to the Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, although that's being unfair to them. They actually document what they do in much more rigorous detail, and the serious attempts to modeling and showing people what they do. The Greenpeace study was done by a German national labs for them. It's hundreds of pages of detail attached to it. One of the things that they do is they assume high oil prices. And this actually is one of the great uncertainties that makes it hard to put your name on a specific number. Because if you're saying, what's the cost of reducing emissions? What's the cost of investing in some kind of gadget that lets you do the same thing with less emissions? You've got the cost of the gadget, and then you've got the savings on fuel to compare to it. And the cost of the gadget doesn't change very fast, but the cost of the fuel sure does. So if you assume, as both Greenpeace and UCS did, that we're going to be back to the kind of oil prices that we saw in the first half of last year, then anybody's scenario looks cheaper. If you assume that we're going to be at very low oil prices, they're going to stay where they are, go down, anybody's scenario looks more expensive. This is one of the big background uncertainties in this area. In addition to that, I think that they are pervasively technologically optimistic, more so even than the McKinsey study. You know, if you want to pursue that direction, they have very detailed studies for you. Greenpeace alone, among the studies that we looked at, thought that you could phase out nuclear power fairly quickly at the same time as getting down to a low emissions level. Everyone else assumed that nuclear power would stumble along more or less as it is. This is a picture of one of these McKinsey cost curves where they line up the, you know, starting with benefits exceeding the cost on the cheapest things where the energy savings are greater than the costs. After a while, you cross over, but it's fairly low costs, still quite a ways into the scenario. This there's search for McKinsey cost curves. You'll find them. They have become a quasi-standard in the field. They've based on so much research on what's the cost per ton of reducing emissions. A chunk of them can be done for real savings. So suppose the climate protection costs 2.5% of world output. That's within that range we looked at. Is that a big number or a small number? Remember that the gloomy news that we started with is raising the cost of not spending it. It's not raising that cost. U.S. economic growth averages more than 2.5%. So try this thought experiment. Imagine that we stop growing for 1 year and then resume. Then every year we will have 2.5% less than we would have if the growth had continued in that year. So 2.5% per year for a long time is the same as skipping 1 year's growth. If we grow at 2.5%, household incomes would then double in every 29 years instead of every 28 years. For China, the other big emitter, 10% annual growth in some recent years, they can skip 3 months' growth and then resume and have the same effect. Their household income will double in 86 months instead of 83 months, about 7 years. So I want to talk about insurance and worst cases, because a lot of climate change is about worst cases. And let's start with a case that people are familiar with. The average number of residential fires in the U.S. is 0.4% of the number of housing units per year. That, flip the fraction over, that says that the average house has a fire once every 250 years. And that means that if your mortgage didn't require it, you could cancel your fire insurance and spend the money on vacation or better clothes or whatever you like. And that's a really good strategy for raising your standard of living in every year that you don't have a fire. No one has, to my knowledge, has heard me say this and canceled their fire insurance. You do the same thing for healthy young parents buying life insurance. Their risks of death are even lower, and they still buy life insurance. You don't buy fire insurance because you know your house will burn down. You buy it because you don't know that it won't. Right? The double negative actually does mean something different here. And that's the story about climate change, that the reason to spend this, let's say, 1% to 3% of output on climate protection is not that we know that there will be a catastrophic rise in sea levels or any of the other, you know, catastrophic collapse of agriculture and forests, but that we can't be sure it won't happen. And not only that, unlike the fire insurance story, the longer we do nothing, the less unlikely these worst-case disasters become. So think of it in those kind of insurance terms. You know, that almost never happens, right? So can we really afford it? Can we afford to spend 2.5% of our output on something that's not part of our consumption? We're taking it away from ordinary consumption to protect against a remote dangerous threat to our way of life. We've answered that question. We have never spent as little as that on military spending. 68 countries around the world, including a lot of the very large ones, spend at least 2.5% of output on the military. U.S. and China, the top two emitters, spend 4%. Who's going to invade the U.S. or China if they have one-third of their current military budget? Right? Mexico, Thailand? I mean, would both countries be safer if they spent two-thirds of their military budget on climate protection and one-third on the military? Well, it's a greater threat to you. And so finally, what are we going to spend all this money on? They're both short-run and long-run plans that are required, because although I've been trying to convey the possibility of this, we've got to do everything right starting right away. The short-run things, which the McKinsey cost curves identify, have to be done to find all of those low-cost and no-cost emission reduction opportunities. We also have to force the development of new technologies, a topic that came up in that last session. How do you create new technologies? And here, I think it's clear that the government has to play a leading role forcing it. Price signals don't lead to technological revolutions. But the good news here is that we know how to do this. We've done it already. The U.S. government is responsible for the existence of microelectronics. In the 1950s and the 1960s, you look at histories of electronics, nobody else could afford to buy transistors and electronic circuits, but the Pentagon and NASA, you know, cost was no object. They had a mission to accomplish. They bought them and brought the price down. So let's look at that as the successful model. We know how to, and we have, turned the world economy upside down. How the Pentagon invented the microelectronics has nothing to do with cost-benefit analysis, by the way. First, you detect a fundamental threat to our way of life. Then you announce a massive mobilization to defeat this. You set an impossible performance target. And you spend huge amounts of money. The best and the brightest minds of the generation are attracted both by the impossible target and by the huge amounts of money. And pretty soon you have a new technology. So here's a picture to leave you with of the development of new technology. These guys in the 1950s looking at something in there, something in a computer. You know, what are they saying? Maybe we could hook one of those televisions up and invent a graphical user interface. Or if we fit this all on a silicon chip, our grandchildren can play games on their phones. Or think how much more useful this will be after we invent the internet, too. We are at that point in the development of the technologies which will be needed 50 years from now. They could not possibly foresee what was going on. The government, for very different purposes, as it turns out, forced the development of these technologies, pushed these gentlemen with their excellent haircuts into this future. And we need to do that again. It's possible because we've done it. The low-carbon technologies that will turn the future economy upside down will be no more foreign than microelectronics was to them. There's the book I was going to talk about before this new report came out, Can We Afford the Future, and various websites, the E3 network. Real Climate Economics is another project of that network. SEI, notice one letter different, SEI-US is where I work. And in lieu of a business card, that's me. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. I'm the journalist on the panel, so I get to make the simple-minded remarks. I had the pleasure of talking with Professor Ackerman in the past, and I mentioned this because the topic was cost-benefit analysis. And this is relevant for a couple of reasons. One is that the topic centered around the new head of this office in the OMB that oversees regulations, who believes in cost-benefit analysis, and there's some question about how it will be applied. But also, it was very striking in your presentation that you neglected the cost of benefits altogether. And if you're talking about the economics of climate change, it's sort of missing half of the story to do that. And there have been attempts to try to quantify the benefits, the Stern report, for example, but, you know, little tiny things like the discount rate that you use to apply to that makes such a huge difference in that. And in some ways, that's been missing from the debate. And also, I think, somewhat missing from the debate has been a real analysis of the kinds of studies that you talked about. You mentioned Eric Pooley at Harvard, and I think that the key message from the study that he did for the Harvard Policy Center was that in many respects journalists have failed to do their real responsibility in covering the claims of the economics of climate change. Now, Bud and Sunshine have done a lot of great work on the previous debate over climate change and whether or not the press was saying on the science of climate change, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, and trying to get a false balance in those kinds of stories. And what Eric Pooley points out in the white paper that he did was that many of the journalists are falling into the same trap on the economics right now. You've got the CRA study, the Chamber study. This is huge costs. You've got Sensenbrenner just a few minutes ago, devastating costs. That gets in the story. Then it quotes the environmental report saying that the cost will be the cost of a postage stamp, and the stories present this as a kind of balance. But in fact, it's a false balance. There are ways to get around this and look at the actual studies coming out with these numbers to try to figure out why the numbers are so different. And I actually went back and looked at my stories and saw the first one I did this back was in 1997 on the economics of climate change. And other than reacting like, boy, I used to be good, it was clear that all those issues were known then, and we've been having this debate over the costs now for 15 years. It's very simple why some of these models differ so much in costs. The EPRI, for example, did a workshop on all these models after looking at the costs of the Lieberman-Warner bill, and the huge difference in costs, and many of them turned upon the adoption of things like nuclear power. If you assume there'd be lots of nukes, low cost. If you assumed hardly any nukes, high cost. And like the CRA study, for example, assumed that there would be hardly any wind. They assumed almost no more wind than we have now, which is completely absurd. But people were out quoting this number as being a real contribution to the debate on costs when it was clearly absurd from the assumptions. If you look at the models on the Waxman-Markey bill, what it really turns on is the offsets. You assume that offsets will be available at a relatively low cost. The bill doesn't cost much. If you assume offsets aren't available, the costs are high. You look in the models, you see that the assumptions are different. But most telling, and this is across the whole spectrum of economic modeling over the years, most telling for me is that you have to really raise the question whether economic modeling can, in fact, capture any kind of technological innovation. It can capture technological switching to technologies that you know exist, but can it capture switching to new technologies which you can't assume will exist? And you see this in things like the SO2 Clean Air Act regulations, where the costs, of course, were predicted to be high. The eventual costs turned out to be low, and one of the main reasons was, of all things, railroads. You could actually bring low-sulfur coal to the East Coast at a low cost and reduce emissions that way rather than expensive scrubbers. And, you know, over and over I've heard this theme that the economic models can't capture that. There's no way of knowing what that's going to be. It makes a huge difference to the result. You know, you're talking orders of magnitudes difference in cost. And so it kind of raises this larger question of whether or not the economic models really contribute much to the debate except to be used by both supporters and the opponents in this political debate. And, of course, that's what we're seeing right now. You know, again, Sensenbrenner such as devastating. The Washington Post was running giant ads this week from opposition groups about how 2 million jobs would be lost because of the bill. Well, that's crap, you know. But it takes a lot of hard work to figure out exactly why those numbers are so wrong and pinpoint the assumptions in the studies that result in these flawed numbers. And so it's sort of a challenge, I think, to the journalism community to get beyond this debate of trying to present these studies and the numbers from these studies as having equal weight, or even raising the question of whether or not the numbers really have much to say about the eventual cost, because, as I said earlier, we don't know what the benefits are, we don't know what the technological innovations will be, and so the eventual numbers, especially if you look retrospectively at past regulations, all the predicted costs usually are wrong by a large amount. The other comments I wanted to make, because unfortunately we don't have the third panelist from Wisconsin Energies, and it's looking at the question of how individual companies can afford to make the switch to a lower carbon future. And, of course, the utility sector is in the crosshairs of this. They're responsible for 40% of U.S. emissions. And, you know, we're never going to get anywhere unless utilities cut back. So did anyone go to the tour yesterday of the carbon capture and storage facility? I'm curious as to your impressions. Is it real? Does it look like it'll work?
Yes, they demonstrated that it's real. That's a totally separate question.
Of the cost.
The utility unsubsidized build an efficient coal plant with sequestration and compete with natural gas, even at double the current prices of many places in the world. Then. So can you sequester? Yes. Can you put, do you see utilities voluntarily doing it, or do they invest in much cheaper ways to generate electricity?
Yeah, I mean, great points. And
can you repeat that, John?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't your name.
Oh, John Addison, author of Safe Gas.
Okay, John Addison pointed out that, and there's a couple of very, very good points. One, because I've been fighting, I don't know if I should say this on the record, but I've been fighting a battle in my own magazine as whether carbon capture storage technology is actually real or not. And there are huge numbers of skeptics. And I say, well, look, you know, there's this thing, Wisconsin Energy's Alstom, the company who's behind it, is putting a huge amount of money into the technology and sees that it's as the next great growth opportunity. So Jim's first point, the technology exists. And the second question is, what is the cost? And just coincidentally, I've done a story looking at the utility sector and asking how it's responding to all these issues. And I know Jim Owens here, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. But it comes down to, again, a very simple-minded thing. And it's, you know, instead of, it used to be, it's the economy stupid, it's the economics stupid. For an individual company, you have to change the incentives in such a way to change your behavior. And I'm thinking of, there's one thing that surprised me so much that it made sense when I heard it. Utilities will pay people money to take their wind energy right now because of the way the economic incentives are structured. You get 1.9 cents tax credit for every kilowatt hour of wind energy you produce. Even if nobody wants it, you can pay someone a cent and a half to take it and you'll still make money. And that's those economics are driving a potential new industry for storage of that wind energy, so you could store it and then sell it for real money instead of selling it for money you're paying someone to take later. But it's the same thing with the carbon capture and storage. The utilities are looking to, again, never underestimate the power of economic self-interest. The utilities are looking to ways in which they can make the most money under whatever scenario they're pushing, which is why we heard Jim Rogers say he's for legislation, because the legislation contains such great incentives for the utilities to make this switch that they would not make on their own, because there's no economic incentive to do so until there's a price on carbon, until there are subsidies for carbon capture and storage, and other things like that. And so the message that clearly comes down in many ways is you can almost, and I look back and I was kind of surprised I made this point in 1997, you can almost forget about the debate of how much it'll all cost and ask a question of, well, how much could we afford right now to put a price on CO2 emissions? Put that price on CO2 emissions through the whatever mechanism you want and see how the economy responds, because that'll give the answer to how much it'll cost. And then depending on that answer, you can ratchet the that price up and down. So those are my simple-minded comments. In some ways, I wanted to ask this larger, perhaps almost facetious question of whether it's even worth doing the economics, in part because they get so misused in the political debate.
Sure. No, I think it's a very good question. Cost-benefit analysis has developed an undeservedly good name. I'm not sure. I mean, before the 1990s, it was not known to be essential for making good public policy, and that idea sort of slipped in there somewhere. The Clinton administration tolerated it, and the Bush administration embraced it with a vengeance, and now it's like Star Wars. It seems to be unstoppable. It doesn't actually make any sense in this case. If you say that we're talking about the risk that the more time we spend at high concentrations of CO2, the more likely it is that we have an abrupt loss of major ice sheets and glaciers, so that sea levels rise tens of feet higher than they are now, flooding all coastal cities and destroying all, you know, fresh water systems all over Asia. What's that worth? You know, how many dollars is that worth? And how would you tell if you had spent 20% too much preventing that? You know, what would you tell your grandchildren if you had spent 20% too much to prevent that from happening? Nobody thinks that way, except for people who are bemused by cost-benefit analysis. In the way that people think about policy is that things like this are taken as absolutes. Of course we don't want to have, you know, melting ice sheets to a level that destroys all the world's coastal cities and all of Asia's freshwater systems. Of course not. And so then the interesting economic question, which is a much more tractable question, is what's the least cost way to prevent that? That's a much better defined question. It's a cost-effectiveness question, which is very different from cost-benefit analysis. You know, there are plenty of examples. You know, when you talk about children's exposure to lead, there actually were people during the last administration who wanted to do a cost-benefit analysis of what was each IQ point lost to lead worth and how did we know when we were spending too much on prevention of lead. Well, most people who have not had the benefit of thinking about cost-benefit analysis think that zero is a really good amount of lead to expose their children to, and what's the cheapest way to expose your children to zero lead is an interesting economic question. I mean, it's in one case after another, people don't actually think that way. I've been under constant pressure from environmental groups that just want a number. I've tried to do estimates of partially, you know, what are the costs of some parts of climate damages that the United States can expect. It's easy to come up with relatively big numbers for relatively partial estimates. I'm not sure, you know, that advances anyone's understanding, although it gives people something to say back to the Jim Sensenbrenners in congressional debates. That's, I think, is its main use. I think that the economics ought to be focused on cost-effectiveness of reaching standards that we know we want to reach. It should not be charged with cost-benefit analysis to tell us exactly how much lead to expose our children to or exactly how much risk of climate change is okay to live with.
Let me ask it in a slightly different way. If I were Sensenbrenner, or not to pick on him, or not the chamber who's here, maybe NAM, I would take a look at your analysis and say, look, even the optimists predict it's going to cost us 2.5% of GDP to do this. That's, you know, trillions of dollars. We can't afford it. So just having a number like that plays into the hands of the opponents, it seems to me.
But that's what led to the title of this book. Supposing we know what we need to do to create a sustainable future for our children and grandchildren, and we conclude that because of other budgetary pressures, we can't afford to do it. Well, we could have one last party and pull the plug. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. This isn't, you know, if you know what is needed to protect a way of life, to say that you can't spend 2.5% of current income to protect it. I mean, you know, we face this problem, right? These guys got funding because of the Cold War, because it was imagined that there was a fundamental threat to our way of life to which we had to spend huge amounts of money. Nobody complained that their parents or grandparents spent 10% less at the mall because they were paying taxes to support the Cold War. Right? That's not part of anybody's recollection of that experience in U.S. history, that we were impoverished during those years because of the taxes that we paid. There's tremendous debate about the military threat and was it a sensible response to it, but in fact, some large chunk of that went to inventing, force starting the microelectronics because no one could afford computers back when they looked like this except the government. No one could afford integrated circuits in the beginning. The same thing is true with wind power and that whole question about what are utilities going to do. 30 years ago, nobody could afford wind power. It got huge government subsidies. And the federal government subsidized it, California, Germany, and Denmark. And after just 20 or 30 years of subsidies, it's on the threshold of competing in the private market. Same thing with the microelectronics, 20 or 30 years of subsidies, and it's ready to be a private market success story. That's how you invent technologies. That's how you transform an economy.
Sorry, John. I was just going to say, I think we should open this up to questions now, and we don't have a microphone. Is there one back there? No. We don't have a microphone in here, unfortunately, so if you could just stand up and say who you are and ask your question, and then the speakers, please restate the question for everyone. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the question is, if the debate in Congress really is about how much it's going to cost, shouldn't we have some estimates of how much it's going to reduce output if we have climate change?
So,
yeah. As John mentioned, I think the Stern Review tried to do this for world estimates, and they came up with averaging over a 200-year span, 5 to 20% of world output, depending on how you estimated it, which they thought could be 90% of that could be prevented by spending 1% of world output. So it was an obviously good deal. I've been engaged in two attempts to do this for the U.S., one for the state of Florida, one for the U.S. as a whole. They're all on our website here, the seius.org. You just Google for my name is probably as fast a way to find them as any. So we said we couldn't possibly evaluate all of the damages, but we pick a few categories: hurricane damages, tourism losses, that sort of thing, energy system costs, water system costs, and quickly came up with 5% of state output in Florida being lost to a few categories, close to 2% of U.S. output being lost to a very partial accounting of the kind of climate damages. Those numbers are very partial numbers. They often look much larger than the costs of the policies that are being debated. But I think for the reasons we talked about, there is no hope of getting a truly complete number. And the comparison of complete costs to incomplete estimates of benefits doesn't have much logical status as a cost-benefit analysis.
And just very quickly, there's been a conscious decision on the part of the supporters not to go that route, not scare people with the concepts of climate change, and to fight this out as a green jobs kind of issue rather than as a save the planet kind of issue. Now, you can quibble with that and challenge that, perhaps legitimately, but that's the direction the political debate has moved.
Next question.
I'm Rob Davis with San Diego. At the gas station on the way to the airport, there was a big threatening poster of Uncle Sam warning that the price of a gallon of gas when cap and trade, if one gets passed, was going to go up by 77 cents. I'm curious, what do you have to assume to get there?
I haven't done that calculation. I think you have to assume a much lower cap than anyone has yet talked about.
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, gas station has a scary poster of Uncle Sam telling you that cap and trade will raise the price of gasoline by 77 cents a gallon, and what calculation leads to that. I don't believe that that can be deduced from the caps that are being talked about now. I think that's too high by a factor of 3 or 4.
Yeah, I talked to CBO about this, and one of the misconceptions in that ad, which had other things, is that they just took the cost of allowances and then divided it up among households without looking at the fact that those allowances would be actually returned to people. So it was completely disingenuous.
So the question of how the health factors into the economics, living near a power plant that leads to a lot of pollution, there's discussion in some of the climate economics about the co-benefits of reducing emissions, that you not only get reduced CO2, but you also get reduced other air pollutants, because burning coal, burning gas leads to other kinds of air pollutants. And it certainly is the case that if you correctly accounted for those, it would look like it was a lower cost, that it's lowering the use of coal, lowering the use of any fossil fuel as a way to reduce other pollutants at the same time as reducing CO2. No, I don't. The question is: Does calling it a co-benefit mean that the other pollution is a norm? It's only awkward bureaucratic language which has evolved around it. I don't think anybody assumes that. I think it's assumed that if you could calculate the health benefits as well, or the benefits of reducing criteria air pollutants as well as CO2, that you would calculate a much bigger benefit for reducing the use of coal.
Well, in a completely parallel track, EPA is already working on PM, the particulate matter reductions. So that's occurring. That'll occur whether or not climate reductions occur.
Christy George from Oregon Public Broadcasting. And public companies are legally required to maximize their quarterly profits to their shareholders. Should that rule be modified in order to do something about climate change? And this sounds like a Michael Moore question, but I asked it of a top executive at BP who answered yes. She would like to see a 3-year profit reporting, which would give more flexibility to do work on climate change.
Do you want to...
The question is, since
companies are so driven by quarterly profits, if they could have more flexibility to tackle climate change, if that were changed to a 3-year reporting. Putting aside the question of whether that would be feasible or not, which is highly unlikely, it still leaves you with the fundamental thing that they still won't do it unless it's profitable. They're still in the same bind. It may give them a little more time to get there, but they're still in the same bind, which is why the economics of this are just so important. And they're making decisions based upon their projections of the economics. So now, Rogers is interesting because he says they're making their decisions already based upon a price on carbon and legislation going through. And utilities in some ways have to do that because they see this inevitable. They're making these, pity the poor CEO, they're trying to make a decision for the next 40, 50 years, and they don't know yet what the rules are. They could go cut down completely the wrong path and completely screw the economics of the company and their shareholders and get pushed out of office. So difficult decisions for them. But it's why, again, and I need to repeat this, why it's important to have these very, very clear price signals so that they can make decisions and still maintain their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders.
Hi,
Kim Kastens from Columbia University. How does the current severe recession interact with your ideas about climate economics, both as the recession has played out so far and as you see it coming in the immediate future?
So the question is, how does the recession today or in the future affect these plans? To some extent, it gives a little breathing room and slows down the pace of emissions growth because a slower economy has lower emissions, so that there's a little pause in the relentless growth of emissions. Not in the historical sweep of things, it probably won't be that long, but it I think the opportunity that it creates is there are a lot of people out of work, and if there were plans to get moving on renewable energy, on energy efficiency, there are a lot of people who could now be hired to do that without competing with other private enterprises.
So you mentioned two possible upsides or advantages of the existence of the recession. Are there downsides as well, in your view?
Are there downsides to it as well? Do people get more anxious about change when the economy is down, maybe less willing to move ahead?
Not
sure.
Well, I think very quickly, two downsides. One is that these arguments of taking more money out of people's pockets ring much louder. Two, you talk to utilities, and they're just scrambling to cut costs and not lose money in the next quarter. They don't have time to think about these larger things. In terms of opportunity, famously, the Obama administration said, let's not waste a good crisis. Having covered renewable energy, energy efficiency for so long, these are staggering amounts of money being put in through the stimulus. People used to argue about getting $5-10 million for some of these things, and now it's in the billions of dollars. It's mind-boggling, and we'll see what happens. I want to make another point about economics that was raised when you talked about the Greenpeace assumption of the oil prices being so high. This is a pet peeve of mine that I don't think many people really think about, and I may be wrong, but imagine that a lot of these renewable energies come on stream. We have plug-in hybrid cars. We reduce fossil fuel consumption dramatically. Well, what happens if you reduce fossil fuel consumption? Suddenly you have your wash and supply. What happens when your wash and supply prices plunge? Okay, your wash and cheap oil and natural gas could undo everything that you're trying to do. So that, again, puts more impetus on the need for a price on carbon and an increasing price on carbon to prevent that from happening and from undercutting all of this.
We have time for two more quick questions. There's one right here from Bill and then one from Jim Downey.
Bill Kavirik, University of Western Ontario. What's your impression of the European experience with feed-in tariffs as opposed to American tax credits?
It's been a tremendous... What has been the experience with feed-in tariffs in Europe, which both Germany and Spain did. And, of course, Spain found that it was so highly subscribed they had to cut back, and which has caused a little hiccups in the industry and a great debate over how many jobs created. But there's no question at all that it's catapulted Germany into the world leader in both in the deployment of renewable technologies and in the manufacture of it. And, we heard in the earlier session about this sort of competitive stuff and Sensenbrenner fulminating about jobs moving offshore. Well, those jobs are in Germany because of this, because they took the lead in stimulating the industry through the feed-in tariffs. Those jobs are now in Germany, and they're probably in China and not here. So it clearly has been far more effective. It had been a large cost, so there has to be debate about the cost. Here, the problem with the tax credits has been that over the years, they've been renewed every year, and there's this great uncertainty whether they will continue. And every time that they're threatened to lose them, the industry goes in the tank. And so it has not been a very effective strategy for stimulating the industry here.
Jim.
I like what you said, Frank, about how the question we ought to be asking is, what's the least cost way that we can prevent this kind of catastrophic climate change? And California, state government has been trying to do an economic analysis of what the best way to meet our climate reduction goals are, which is to get back to 1990 emission levels by 2020. And their first stab at it last fall was just slammed by all the economists who peer-reviewed it. And now they're trying to re-
So the question is, if you say that the right way to think about it is the least cost path, is that really something that you can calculate?
Yeah.
Well, there always are uncertainties. I mean, the pace of technical change is a big uncertainty. We've never had zero technical change. So if you're projecting decades into the future, you want to project something, but it is very hard to know what to project. This kind of curve, the McKinsey cost curve, which I put back up here, is, I think, a good way to go in terms of short-term opportunities. They were looking out about 20 years and saying, what is it that seems feasible? What's the cost net of energy savings of each of the several hundred technologies they looked at, and then lined them up in order of increasing cost per ton of CO2, with quite a chunk of them that are free, and then another chunk that are just very low cost. So if you had such a curve done accurately, you could just march up it until you'd gotten enough emissions, and that would be, schematically, that would be the least cost based on what we know now. Now, technologies can change. The farther out in time you're looking, the more you have to be thinking also about this question of what technologies do we want to be pushing? What kind of initiatives will push the development of the new technologies? This is a 20-year, not a 50-year look.
One quick caveat, in talking with McKinsey about those curves, they say, yeah, those things exist, but not for long. If you don't start doing them now, you lose those opportunities.
Okay, I'm afraid that I have to wrap this up now, and we are actually going to continue in the following session that includes lunch, by the way, right next door, and that will feature James Hamilton from Duke, Sharon Dunwoody from the University of Wisconsin, and Roger Dower from the Johnson Foundation to continue this conversation with a different perspective. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Frank and John.